This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Diane Fanning is the author of 14 true crime books published by St. Martin's Press and Berkeley Books, including the Edgar Award-nominated Written in Blood, about Michael Peterson of Netflix, The Staircase, and the best-selling Mummy's Little Girl, about the infamous Casey Anthony case. For the work she began with Through the Window, about serial killer Tommy Lynn Sells, she received the Defender of Innocence Award from the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project. Diane's 14 true crime books are Written in Blood, Baby Be Mine, Under the Knife, Gone Forever, Through the Window, The Pastor's Wife, A Poisoned Passion, Mummy's Little Girl, Her Deadly Web, Sleep My Darlings, Under Cover of the Night, Out There, Bitter Remains, and Death on the River. We will discuss how her incredible true crime writing career began, the cases and books that most affected her career, and what's next for the incomparable author. The book that we're featuring this evening, the story this evening, is Diane Fanning, True Crime Retrospective, with my special guest, journalist and author, and a show favorite, Diane Fanning. Welcome to the program, Diane Fanning.
Hi, Dan. Great to be with you and your listeners today.
It is always a pleasure having you on, and especially now to talk about all of the books that you have had in your collection, 14 true crime masterpieces, many of these true crime classics, and by any standard. And here we're going to talk about them today. Diane, take us back to Baltimore, Maryland, you growing up. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and this incredible incident when you were 9 years old that certainly had some influence in your true crime writing career.
Well, I was born in Baltimore and started my first few years in the city itself, and then we moved out to Baltimore County when I was six. I had just a pretty normal upbringing, I'd say. When I was nine, though, and this car pulled up, and he said that he was lost, and could we give him directions? So he told us where he wanted to go, and we tried to explain to him where it was. And he said, I don't understand. Could you please come up and look at my map? Well, he threw open his car door, and I walked up in total innocence. And he, instead of a map, was showing his genitals. And I was shocked. I mean, I was like frozen in place. And he grabbed my upper arm and started tugging on me. I was resisting for all it was worth, but I was a little kid, small in size for my age, and I was just about to lose my footing and go into that car when another car came up over the hill and laid on its horn. He let go of me and drove off with his car door still open. I had been a big fan of Dragnet reruns on TV, and I knew exactly what Sergeant Friday wanted me to do. So I memorized the license plate number. And I went home, and I told my mom, and she called the police. And they stopped the guy a couple days later, and in the trunk of his car, they found evidence that he had sexually assaulted and murdered an 8-year-old girl the month before.
Wow.
It was kind of stunning to me because, well, I had to see his face on TV, which was shocking. And I was also very confused. I mean, I wanted to know, why was I chosen to be a victim? And I wanted to know, how could someone do something like that? It seems so horrible to me and so against everything that I'd been taught as I was raised. And so I wanted to do some reading, and I was a bit of a precocious kid, so I drugged my mother to the library and made her sign, because at that time you couldn't sign out books from the adult section when you were just a little kid. So she signed so that I could, and I was getting out criminal psychology books with a dictionary by my side, and that started my interest in true crime.
Now, you write about going to college in Virginia and writing
Yes.
for radio and television, working for an ad agency. How did that prepare you for writing in general? And tell us about how you got in the position. What are the circumstances with your very first book deal?
Well, the writing of commercials and promotional announcements and public service announcements taught me the importance of being concise. So that became a natural trait for me. When I wrote, and it wasn't, you know, you can only put so much in 30 seconds, so many words. I think 75 was the recommended count. And so I learned to get right to the point, because I wrote a lot of theater of the mind kind of spots.
Right.
And I quickly realized that instead of having to cut things out when I started writing books, I really had to plump things up a little bit, because I was being very sparse in my writing. And so that was kind of a different way to come at it. But I had been trying to get an agent for 2 years, and this is the message to anybody out there that wants to write a book. 2 years I tried without getting an agent.
Yeah.
Keep
yeah.
trying. And yeah. Finally, one day, I was home alone, and I was flicking among channels on TV, and I came upon 48 Hours, and this little girl named Crystal Searles, and she was telling her story. And it, like, resonated with me immediately, because what she said was like what I did when I was 9 times 100.
Right.
Crystal Searles sat there on the top bunk and watched a serial killer murder her best friend. Then he slit her throat and left her for dead. That little child got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and walked barefoot down a gravel road where there were tarantulas and poisonous rattlesnakes and cactus and Lord knows what else in far west Texas. And she got to a house where she found a man who had an interesting hobby. Every year he got up to watch TV and see every New Year's arrive all around the world. So he was up watching New Year's arriving, I think in Australia or New Zealand or something. And so he came right to the door and he saw her and she couldn't speak. She had a huge blood clot on her neck and she couldn't say a word because her vocal cords had been cut. So she motioned for a pencil and paper and he got it. She wrote, "Get the cops." He killed everybody. And so he got her in and made her comfortable while he got an ambulance for her. And then she was airlifted to San Antonio where she went into surgery. And she's 10 years old, just 10 years old. She goes into surgery. She comes out. Her vocal cords have been repaired, but she's still not capable of speech. And she wrote another note, "Get the cops." And they brought them in, and they brought a forensic artist. And without being able to speak, this little child communicated so well that with the drawing they had, they knew within an hour exactly who it was. And they were able to make plans, go out and arrest that man who was planning another murder that day before he left town.
Wow.
And that was like, wow, she is my hero. And I had to write her story. It was like a passion. It wasn't like, oh, I really would like to write her story, maybe, kind of. It was, I had to. So I sat right down and I wrote the chapter, the few things I knew from the show I'd watched, and I wrote the chapter. And at that time, you weren't supposed to email anything to agents. It all had to be by the regular mail. But I thought, well, heck, you know, that hasn't been working for 2 years. So I sent an email to Jane Distel with the first chapter. And within 24 hours, I was signed up with a new agent. So then I didn't know what to do. I mean, I really was totally ignorant of everything to do with writing books. So she spent a couple of months teaching me how to write a proposal and making corrections. And we went back and forth in the mail with this until I finally got it to the point where she said, okay, I'll send it out. Well, she sent it out, and in a week, she got offers from two publishers for a two-book deal. So I had to pick my publisher, which was something I never expected I'd have to do. But I picked St. Martin. And so there I was. You know, I had a little bit of panic in my heart because I knew I didn't know what I was doing. And I also didn't have any idea what that second book would be. And so I just got busy. I mean, I just taught myself as I went. I didn't know any of the rules, didn't know what I was doing, but I figured it all out. You know, I wrote for my high school newspaper, so I used what I learned there from doing interviews and a short internship at a major city newspaper to guide me to what I needed to do. And I did a lot of reading on the side. And then I hit this one really tricky place where I didn't know which way to turn. Somebody was asking something of me that didn't really seem ethical. So I called up Ann Rule. And Ann Rule was very, very sweet. She was very kind. She gave me time. And she said to me, "Oh, you're writing about that case? Oh, they wanted me to do that, but I wouldn't do it. It was going to be too much work." And so that's why ignorance is bliss. You step into something that you don't know because you don't realize how hard it's going to be, but you learn the hard way. And I surely did. It was a big lesson. And I'm so glad that I didn't let my fears and uncertainty stop me from doing that, because that book actually resulted in one woman getting a new trial and being acquitted and ultimately getting a certificate of innocence from the state of Illinois. And then there's another guy, and that was Julie Ray. And then there's this other guy, Rodney Lincoln, who I never mentioned him or his case or anything, but because of the fact that the way I described the crimes and everything, and I was willing to be interviewed, and I said it could have been Sells. It very well could have been Sells. He was able to get out of prison after decades. So it's just amazing to me that, well, Sells put it best. He says there are a whole lot of people in prison for crimes I committed, and I don't care.
Wow. Incredible. That was an incredible start to your career. Let's talk about Written in Blood, about Michael Peterson. And I mentioned that for people that, just to reference Netflix, The Staircase, because so many people tuned into that series. Tell us about your experience in writing Written in Blood.
Well, that was back in the day when Court TV was broadcasting trials live, and they broadcast the whole trial live, all 3.5 months, I think it was, of it. And I think they even had jury selection there. Yes, they did. But I went up for part of jury selection. I was there at least 1 week every month so I could get the flavor of the live and to meet lots of people and make contacts for interviews. And it was just fascinating because I went there. I wasn't certain of this man's guilt. I thought, he's a novelist. Novelists don't kill people.
Right.
Well, then the evidence started rolling in. And, you know, the people who were doing the original version of The Staircase, which was a French film company, and theirs aired on Sundance, I mean, they were so convinced that he just wasn't guilty. And they were doing all the taping directly from the defense point of view. I mean, they didn't really care what the prosecutors wanted to say or anything. And they left out some very vital evidence, the evidence that I and the two nurses on the jury both found absolutely compelling. One of them was a thing called red neurons. Red neurons are something that form in your brain when you slowly bleed to death.
Okay.
And Kathleen had those found at autopsy. They were in her brain. And that made a complete and total lie of everything Michael Peterson said had happened that night. Because he said it was a half hour to 45 minutes. Well, those red neurons have never been recorded as forming in less than 2.5 hours. So that right away, there you got a serious problem with the evidence. And the other thing is they had this state witness that did the blood spatter and stuff like that. And he was discredited for some of the things he did. And so you can't really count anything he testified to, except to me, there was one vital thing that mattered. And that's because he testified to something that the defense witness, Dr. Henry Lee, agreed with wholeheartedly. And that was the fact that in that stairwell, there was a point of impact where something hit the back of Kathleen's skull in midair.
Yeah.
So, there, you know, that when the defense witness supports the prosecution witness, you know you've got a fact. And I will always be convinced that Michael Peterson was guilty of that crime and guilty of the murder of Liz Ratliff. And he, you know, I talked to him in the courtroom, and he said that in another interview with BBC, he said that we never talked, we never shared a word, and he was just busy name-dropping with me when he was talking and digging for information. And his agent threatened my publisher and said that if they published my book, you know, that was it. He wouldn't get any more of that guy's clients. And the agent, I can't recall his name, but he was a big deal. And but you know, I got to credit St. Martin's. They continued on. They didn't pull back at all. In fact, they didn't let me know about it until the book was out. And it was, from what I hear, on air and off air, Michael Peterson disparages me everywhere he goes.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
But that's okay. Because I know who he is, and I know what he is.
Absolutely. Let's talk about another, if you can get more controversial than that, let's talk about one of the most controversial cases in history. And that's the 3-year-old Kaylee Anthony's disappearance from her home in Florida in July 2008, subject of your book, Mummy's Little Girl. Tell us about the writing of Mummy's Little Girl.
Well, the writing of Mummy's Little Girl was insane, absolutely insane, because it was a feeding frenzy for media at the time. I was getting the facts down. But
sure.
I did manage to get some inside track on a lot of things, and it was really good. And the prosecutor had an interesting philosophy on making records public. He said, if I give them to the defense, then I've given them to the enemy, so I might as well give them to the public. So official records were very easy to come by, and as long as you got credentialed by the DA's office. So I was able to do that, and I had one luxury that no one else did. My book came out before the trial. It was 17 months before the trial. So I was able to state very clearly what I thought happened to that child, how Casey Anthony murdered that little girl. And I did have to put a legal caveat in with it that the lawyer crafted, but still, I laid it all out exactly what happened. And the evidence was there, Dan. It was as clear as day. It may have been a little complicated because sometimes scientific reports are complicated, but the jury did not ask to look at any of them. And by their own mouth, in interviews after the trial, they said that the defense raised reasonable doubt about her father. Well, that is absolutely nuts. There was no testimony leading to the fact that her father might have committed that crime. The only thing was there was the opening and closing statements of the defense. Opening statements and closing statements are not evidence. They are arguments.
Right.
They're not supposed to be taken as the truth. And yet that jury did. And I am so certain of it because, I'm sorry, they did not find her guilty of even child abuse or neglect. And if a mother has a missing child and does not report it for more than a month, if that's not child abuse, it's child neglect, period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Incredible. That was an incredible case. And a surprising, very, very surprising verdict. Like you say, this last-ditch
yes.
effort by the closing statement, so nobody had any indication. In fact, it was the indication that she'd certainly be convicted, and yet a very, very surprising verdict.
Yeah, you know, I've never been one of those people to support professional jurors, but after that trial, you know, you start rethinking it. Because I just don't think I don't think all that jury understood what they were doing. And anybody on that jury who really understood what they were supposed to be doing and came to that verdict was just not following what they needed to do. They didn't ask for anything. No, they didn't ask for any scientific statements that they could try to decipher. They didn't ask for a thing. And that was very, very troubling.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another troubling case here. We didn't talk about this in an interview. I never interviewed you about this because this was back before 2010, but this is a book, one of your books called Under the Knife. And
yes.
Dean Failio had built a thriving beauty business. There was one problem with this thriving cosmetic surgery business. Tell us about Under the Knife.
Well, he was well loved by his clients, and they just thought the world of him. And one segment of his client base were men who were transitioning to be women, and one of their biggest problems was the fact they grew beards. Well, he was really great at doing the laser there, but if you're not a doctor, you're not supposed to be doing that. So basically, he was practicing medicine without a license. And when he got caught, you know, he was investigated by the health department, and he was up against charges. And so they said, and he was also given prescriptions. And so they said, well, if you help us get the doctors that enabled you to do this, the ones that signed off on prescription pads and left them blank so you could use them, then we'll consider that when we consider your punishment. So he was cooperating. Everything was going well. And they did, because of his cooperation, get the medical license jerked from two doctors. But meantime, he realized that this laser was really a good business. He set up in an apartment in Chelsea and was running his laser business there. And this woman who was a Filipino immigrant and had been doing so well in this country, she was making a six-figure salary at Barclays. I mean, she was no lightweight. But yet she was taken in by Fialo, and she went to see him for a condition she had on her tongue that he said he could fix with laser. Well, unfortunately, he didn't know enough medicine to understand how critical dosage of lidocaine can be. And on top of that, he was injecting it into her tongue. And the tongue is the most vascular system in the whole body. And that lidocaine went in, there was too much of it, and it like threw her into seizures. So Dean calls up a neighbor of his in Newark who is an emergency room physician. and asked him what I should do. He said, listen, three blocks away from you, there is a trauma center. You need to get her there immediately, or her chances of survival are next to none. Well, Dean thought, well, I'm already in trouble. I'm going to go to prison for this for sure. I think I'll just wait a little while and see if she pulls out of it. Well, he gambled with her life, and she lost. She died right there in that apartment. Dean folded up her small body, put it in a little rolling suitcase, and took it out to his vehicle, drove back to his million-dollar mansion in Newark, and out in the carriage house, he buried her and covered her body with concrete. Then he sold the house and moved to Costa Rica. It was only because his boyfriend in New York started thinking about all the little things that hadn't seemed right before Dean left town. And he went to the police saying that maybe this missing woman has something to do with Dean Faiello. So they searched his house, and Greg had told them about the concrete he had poured in the carriage house. So they ripped that up and found the suitcase containing her body.
Yeah. Incredible. Let's talk about Baby Me Mine, the very first episode of True Murder. You were gracious enough to come on and talk about a book you had written a little bit before that called Baby Be Mine. Bobby Jo Stinnett is pregnant, 8 months pregnant, and this is a very, very unusual case, I thought, at that time, but as we discussed, it's not without its other precedents of this type of case. Tell us just a little bit about Baby Be Mine, and how hard of a book to write was Baby Be Mine and a case to investigate?
It was extremely difficult because I had a daughter that same age at the time as Bobby Jo. And to talk to the mother of Bobby Jo and have every conversation end in horrible wailing, to the point where she had her best friend call me up and tell me everything she wanted to say, since she was capable of doing it. And the brutality of the crime, absolutely brutal, brutal crime. I had never heard of cesarean abduction before. And it's rare, but it had happened enough that the FBI had written a special report about it. Bobby Jo was a sweet woman. She raised rat terriers. She worked in a pet shop. She loved animals. She was a barrel racer, sweet small town girl. And she was about to have her first baby, and she was so excited about it. And she just happened to talk about it in the wrong places. She was on a chat group and basically became the victim of an internet scam by a woman named Lisa Montgomery. Lisa was in a marriage and her second husband, and he was losing interest, quickly losing interest, but she knew he loved children, because he'd taken in her children. She had four from a previous marriage, and he was just great as a father. So she figured the only way to save her marriage was to have a child. But the problem was she'd had a tubal ligation. Her current husband knew nothing about that, and she proceeded to fake her pregnancy. And her husband, who had physically lost interest in her, was just delighted to be let off the hook of that part of the relationship. And so she went online, and first she was scamming one woman who was pregnant with twins. So she was telling everybody she was pregnant with twins. And then that woman miscarried and lost both babies. Then she moved on and said, oh, it wasn't twins after all. It was, yeah, it just, I'm going to have a baby girl. And that's when she scammed Bobby Joe Stinnett. And she led Bobby Joe under a false name to believe that she was looking for a rat terrier puppy. And Bobby Joe gave her directions to her house to come look at the puppies and pick one out. When they got there, Bobby Joe must have recognized her because she'd seen her at other rat terrier shows. And probably started running right away. Lisa went after her, slit her up the middle. She passed out, and Bobby removed the body, started to remove the baby's body. And Bobby Joe came to, got up, and was fighting for her life. And that's when Lisa Montgomery strangled her to death. And then left the house with the baby and drove back to her home a state away. Bobby Joe's mother found Bobby Joe's body. And she called the sheriff and she said, my God, it looks like she exploded.
Incredible.
I can't imagine being that mother. I just can't imagine. It's so horrific. And so that made it very, very difficult to do. And in the process, I was learning a whole lot about that town of Skidmore. You know, McElroy had been there many years before. He'd been gunned down in the street by his neighbors who were justly distressed at the way he was shooting at other citizens and how his lawyer was always kicking him off and he was not going to prison. He'd been cattle rustling too and a lot of other things, and he just was the town bully. And they finally had enough. And there were a lot of people that witnessed it, and he was shot dead and nobody would talk. Nobody. And then there was this weird thing. It was just, by the time I went there were only 350 people living there. And two of Bobby Joe's cousins by marriage were also killed within a 5-year period of her murder. One of them by an absolutely vicious domestic violence assault. And the other one, Branson Perry, just went missing and his body's never been found. And there was a man who had written about murdering Branson without naming him, but it sounded very much like that. And he was arrested because he was involved in a pornography plot with child pornography with a medical student in Atlanta, and they both got busted for that. But they've never been able to find proof that he actually did kill Branson. And when I was there, there was as much interest in Bobby Joe by the people who would talk to me as there was in Branson Perry and what happened to him, and nobody knowing what happened to him. And the other people in town, there were people that spoke to me, but there were others who, I mean, literally I was run out of a restaurant. I was run away. I was run off and not allowed into a convenience store. I knocked on a window, saw someone staring at me and turn and walk away. I mean, it was bizarre. It was a very unwelcome place, and I thought, well, maybe Northwest Missouri is like this. But I went to other little towns around there, and no, they weren't. That town was so scarred by the McElroy story that they trusted no stranger at any time.
Yes. Truly, truly astonishing case. Let's use this as an opportunity, Diane, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. The Spring 2020 box has been revealed and is now on sale for a limited time. My wife, Lisa, starts every day looking fabulous with goat milk moisturizing cream from Kate Somerville. She says it's essential. She says it's especially soothing during the dry winter months. She ends her day with the makeup eraser. Again, essential, she says. Now, we both eat healthy, and now she's back at the gym regularly. Now she's looking and feeling better every day. For fun, we both get outside and get some fresh air, but it's also a lot of fun for Lisa getting turned on to all the great products FabFitFun has to offer. These are the kinds of products, the milk moisturizing cream, the goat milk moisturizing cream, and the makeup eraser. These are the products that Lisa chose for her box, but every box is different for every person. You want to be surprised? No worries. The FabFitFun team will curate a selection of products just for you. FabFitFun is happiness delivered straight to your door each season. Choose from a variety of beauty, fashion, fitness, and wellness products to customize your very own spring box. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. That's use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Diane, let's talk about another incredible case, another book that you have written. Let's talk about Bitter Remains.
Oh, my. Well, you know, one of the things I always look for in a true crime book is a case that has something different that I can learn from. And I'd never done a dismemberment before. So that was part of what drew me to that. The other thing was the cast of characters. You had a musician who, although he wasn't, you know, a big star, he did performances in the Caribbean. He did performances up and down the East Coast. He was well loved in his hometown of Raleigh, and that was one of the characters. Then you had an actress who had been in the new version of the Stepford Wives. And to top it off, you had an artist. So what an odd combination, an actress, a musician, and an artist in this love triangle. And it was really very bizarre. And the bottom line was the custody of the children. Laura had married him because they were in love. I mean, they even shared a birthday. I mean, it was like fate. So they were married. At least that's what Laura thought. But then she had two little boys. And unbeknownst to her, when she had to return home from the Virgin Islands because her child needed medical care stateside, her husband started an affair with another woman. And Grant, her husband, was ended up returning to New York instead of Raleigh when the woman he was having an affair with returned to New York with her daughter. Then they went to Las Vegas and they took the oldest boy he was visiting with them. And he sent her an email and said, "We just got married. I never signed the papers. Our marriage is null and void."
Wow.
And she was shocked, and she pulled out her papers, and sure enough, he never signed them. And so then began the custody battle of the children. And he had taken that older boy for supposedly just a few days that kept the time kept going on and on. It was months. And we're talking a three-year-old boy, so this is a big deal of time to be away from his mom. And Grant came down and with his new wife, Amanda, and they sued for custody. Only they did it in a way that a legal manner that she wasn't allowed to be there because of the danger to the children. And Laura, she was going to fight for her kids because she knew that Grant used drugs. She knew that Grant had some really crazy, weird ideas. They were like, if you had taken Scientology and Christianity and some mix of lunacy and put it in a blender and churned it all up together. That was his religious belief, and it was really weird, including the fact that he was one of the chosen ones. So she needed to get those kids back. And he had gotten custody. The little guy who was like 18 months was removed from her arms screaming by the sheriff's department. So she wanted to get those guys back, and she went to fight for it. And one of the things that the judge insisted on was a psychological evaluation and drug testing. And so while this was going on, and they were being, all of them, the whole family was being psychologically interviewed, and the psychologist was getting a real portrait of what was going on in that family, and she was going into their homes and checking out their homes. And she was very clear on the fact that neither parent was perfect. And she pointed out the things that Laura needed to do, like she needed to, you know, become more assertive. She needed to work on her self-confidence, and in order to be a better parent and to do a better job of that. And there were Laura, as soon as she got any word of stuff like that, she immediately went out and found mentors and stuff to try to make herself a better parent. She wanted to be a good mother for her boys. And Grant, on the other hand, was absolutely furious when he looked at the report because it talked about him being mentally unstable. It talked about his drug use. And so he flew back saying that, he was saying she was promiscuous. He was saying that she used drugs. I mean, just on and on and on. Anything he could
to defame her with no grounding in fact.
And
so it was real clear when the reports came out from the psychologist that he was not going to get custody of the children. And so he called her up, Laura up, and asked if she wanted to come over and have an extra Wednesday visit with the children, and which was outside of the parameters of the visitation that was currently set up. And he said, and we'll talk about maybe giving custody to you. Well, instead of that, it appears as if she was forced to sign a document that gave up custody of her boys for a sum of $25,000, which was not Laura. Laura would not have signed that unless she was coerced. Now, Laura always took a tape recorder with her and had it turned on for any encounter with Grant, whether it was in person or on the phone. And those she always downloaded to her computer. She had a special site that was shared with her best friend. So they had both had access to all of that. But the funny thing was, there was no tape recorder found in the apartment, Grant's apartment. None found anywhere, anytime, ever. There was a nick on her neck that looked like it was caused by a knife. And I think it's very possible that's what was held to her throat to make her sign that document. There were pools of blood, which all that was left when the cops got into that apartment was a bleach stain. And there, it was just amazing how the whole place reeked of bleach. But there was no Laura. And it turns out that they loaded up the two kids and they got a truck, a U-Haul truck. They put Laura's body in a couple of coolers after cutting it up in the bathroom. They traveled all the way out to Texas from Raleigh, North Carolina, and dumped the contents of those coolers into the creek across the street from Amanda's aunt's house, essentially dumping their problem on her.
Right.
Now, I'm sorry, that is so freaking illogical. People are so illogical so many times when it comes to disposing of evidence. Think of all the places they passed on I-10 in Louisiana where it would be easy to pull off to a bayou and throw stuff and nobody would ever see it because the gators would eat it up faster than the water.
Right.
But no, they put it near a family member's house.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. Thank God they were caught.
Yeah. Thank God for incompetent criminals.
And the thing of it is Amanda, she really, really put it on thick, tried to make herself a victim of Grant just as much as Laura was. It was all an act. She had a different voice and everything. I mean, it was just one big act. And so she didn't get the life without parole sentence that Grant did. She got like 16 to 18 years, I believe. But then the state of Texas, they got into the game. They got her for another 20 years for abusing a corpse.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of all the, you have the opportunity as a highly respected journalist to be able to speak to almost all of these subjects, these people that are involved in these murder trials, many of the players, but many of the perpetrators as well. Let's talk about what book really you had an opportunity to speak to the perpetrator, and it was the most, I would say, important important interview that you did have, the most shocking, the most revealing, the most impressionable interview that you've done for any book?
Well, it had to be Tommy Lynn Sells, because not only did I talk to him, I interviewed him more than 20 times. And I received probably about 100 letters from him. So, and this was my first experience of true crime. And I led a normal sheltered life up to then, and I couldn't, you know, he was the most evil person I'd ever met, but I never met evil people, you know. I met nasty people, mean people, but never evil. And so I didn't know if what I thought had any validity as far as him being most evil. But then Dr. Michael Stone, the forensic psychiatrist out at Columbia University, he had a show called, Most Evil, that's what it's called. And
right.
He interviewed Sells, and he told me that, and put on the show, that Sells got the highest ranking of any of them. And
yeah.
So I said, well, okay. So I started out at the top, or at the bottom, however you look at it.
Absolutely. When you talk about the last book that we discussed, and that is Death on the River, what was markedly different about writing that book and covering that case for you?
What was different was that it was really, really difficult talking to people, to getting documents. It seemed like everybody and their brother had lawyered up. And, you know, I was able to talk to a lot of people on the victim side, but I also like to talk on the perpetrator's side because, you know, it's like when you're writing fiction, if your bad guy has nothing but bad qualities and your good guy has nothing but good qualities, it doesn't ring true. Like, Tommy was the most evil man I knew. He rescued a woman in the middle of a flood, risking his own life. Now, that doesn't sound like a serial killer who would eventually confess to killing over 50 people. But he did it. He tore up floorboards to rescue a kitten who was about to drown under the house. Nothing is absolutely totally black and white. Even the most evil person is capable of a good deed. And the best, most wonderful, angelic person, even probably Mother Teresa, has done something she wishes she hadn't. And that is why I like to talk to people who know both sides. And I did get a little bit of that, but I didn't get as much. And the prosecutor is very, very stingy with any documents, and that made it difficult. I had to really scrape around. And it also seemed to me that police departments have gotten far tighter reins on their detectives and their ability to speak to people. I mean, in order to talk to the guy in charge of that investigation, I had to have the public information officer on the line with me. And a couple times she said, no, you cannot answer that question. So I didn't get information I was going for. It was difficult. And then to see her get off with a slap on the wrist. I don't know. And I kind of doubt that this was a totally premeditated murder, because there were too many things that happened that she couldn't have any control over, like the weather. And I think that she was someone who had thought about his death and was looking for an opportunity, and she saw one. I'm sorry, but if you love somebody as much as she claimed to have loved Vinny, then you would have risked your own life to save that person. I would have done everything. Instead of pulling the oar away, I would have tried to find a way to use it to pull him up to at least tangle to my kayak, so we at least hope to get to shore. I'd probably end up killing myself in the process, but hey, that's love. That's love.
Yes. Now, Diane, we didn't have time to cover all of the 14 books that you have, but I urge people to go and look at these and read for themselves. What is new for you? I know that you are a fictional writer as well, but are you investigating now for a possible book, a true crime book? What's next for Dan Fanning?
I am working on a novel right now. The last three chapters I've got to get done. And I also have a very, very old, like 1840s serial killer thing I'm looking into. And if something contemporary comes up, it seems like nothing is getting the press that St. Martin's Press wants to have in order to get me to write a contemporary book. And the politics are like eating up all the airwaves. So the coverage isn't there, and they want something high profile for me. I mean, I'd rather not do high profile, but, you know, that's what they want. So I'm just waiting on one thing and plotting on another one. And I'm also really, really excited because Through the Window has been bought by a publisher in China, and they are going to translate it into simplified Chinese and come out with a new edition of the book in Chinese. I can't wait to see that.
That is so
That'd be very interesting.
And then,
talk about expanding your market.
And and have you heard about the Netflix Harrison Ford deal?
No.
Okay, not Netflix, excuse me, Staircase. Well, Harrison Ford is supposed to be playing and co-producing a thing about Michael Peterson, and they optioned my book.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. That's amazing.
Yeah, and so I think since Harrison Ford's already committed, it probably will happen, but it hasn't been officially will happen yet.
Yes, well, that's fascinating, and look forward to that. That's incredible. Dan, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about all of your books and your fascinating true crime career that's nowhere near from being over. Thank you very much, Diane, for coming on and doing this true crime retrospective. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. For those that might want to look at other work, is there a Facebook page, a website? Tell us about that, Diane.
Oh, sure. I have a separate True Crime Books page for my true crime on Facebook. And I also have a website which you can read sample chapters from all my books. And that is DianeFanning.com.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Dan. I know we'll be talking to you again soon. You have a great night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.